Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. I'm joined by Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University, and Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School. Sadly, we wanted to be able to have Jay Carson, an Ohio area attorney, but he is currently off doing his own things, or how do you put it, Michael, crushing the little guy in the Ohio
Valley. Underneath his boot heel.
Underneath his boot heel.
Jay's specialty.
I want to make sure that I get that right for you, Jay. And Kristen is also unfortunately unavailable. So it will be the trio of hosts today, myself, Michael, and Ken. Both of you, welcome to the show.
Good to be
Thanks,
here.
Thanks, Trey. Yep.
Well, gentlemen, I think everyone who is listening to the podcast has undoubtedly seen the images and watched the speeches and the speech of President Trump, which happened on Wednesday. And we watched as the crowd came to the Capitol. We watched the events unfold. We gazed in disbelief as fellow Americans attacked the Capitol and no less live streamed it. Now, I'm going to say personally, a little over a year ago, I was in Washington, D.C. once again, a place I have lived for a short time, and I had an opportunity to be present during the impeachment trial in the Senate. And during my whirlwind time in D.C., I saw all of the things of D.C. again. I stood in awe at the Library of Congress. I walked through the halls of the Capitol, recorded notes for this show, as a matter of fact, immediately after the historic vote, and recorded it there in the shadow of the Capitol late in the evening. And if you haven't been to Washington as an adult, it's really hard to understand the weight of the history there. It's hard to understand what it is to be in that presence, to be in the Capitol itself. And so as I watched this personally unfold in real time, as fellow citizens stormed the Capitol, I couldn't help but picture me in all of those places just about 11 months ago. And I couldn't help but being dismayed. And my dismay has led me to ponder what those other fellow citizens were feeling and believing that can lead them to act in that way. And what they do, we know this, they believe in this grand conspiracy that has occurred, that their savior was thwarted by an all-encompassing deep state. And this leads me to my first set of questions for both of you. And I want to start here. What, if any, political ramifications do you predict we're going to have as a result of the events on Wednesday and Thursday? And in your answer, guys, I'm specifically interested in your thoughts related to voting, democratic stability, and how many Americans now consider those two items untrustworthy. Or in short, has the American Republican taken a hit to its institutional pillars? Which of you would like to take that on first?
Wow, there's a lot there, so maybe I'm going to let Ken go first.
You know, I as monumental as yesterday's events seem to be, I don't think they're going to have a significant impact on any of the things you're really talking about. Or if they do, I think it's going to continue some slightly negative trends. For instance, I think a lot of what's now, I think, been conclusively proved to be a very phony kind of alarmism about voter fraud, you know, after we've been hearing alarmism about voter fraud for a decade, you know, there was an enormous amount of investigative resources that went into trying to find some in this election. It was pretty hard to find. But nonetheless, voter fraud, I think, has always been an excuse for imposing restrictions on voting. And I actually think we're going to see that project somewhat assisted by the events of this week. If anything, we're likely to see more restrictions on voting because of the fact that a large number of Americans still believe there was voter fraud. I don't think there's going to be any kind of systematic big kinds of restoring of confidence or loss of confidence, but I think there's going to be a trickle of just continued trends making it harder and harder for people to vote.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I mean, I think we're well into that death spiral that Senator McConnell talked about on Wednesday night. I don't see us pulling out of it. I don't see this having any sort of, you know, positive implications, and possibly, as Ken suggested, some negative ones. This isn't, I don't think, the end of Trumpism. Donald Trump is just a symptom of this ugliness and this awfulness. And I fully expect things to, after a brief little pause where everyone pretends to you know, realize that democracy is somehow important and playing by the rules is important, everyone will go back because the incentives haven't changed for the as it's been called, the wicked, I will say, the evil men and women who decide to put ambition above the health of this democracy, and the evil and wicked media organizations who do the same thing. None of that's changed, and it's just going to get worse. And I was in tears on Wednesday night, and I don't see much really changing.
So, Michael, you have a much more negative view than I hear from Ken. And Ken, that's pretty kind of a consistent view for you. And so I actually had a follow-up question for you. On this show before I had to take a hiatus on our last All Hands on Deck before the election, you argued that the idea of the, quote, not my president phenomenon really wasn't that big of a deal, whether it came from the left or the right. It was kind of unimportant because what really mattered, in your view, you said, was that the key institutional actors recognized the president and operated properly. So my question for you is a little bit of a pushback. Is in the light of the events on Wednesday, do you still stand by that, specifically given that we had 121 House members and 6 senators who, even after the events on Wednesday, continued to object to the Electoral College votes? In other words, do you still think there is a basis to argue that the institutional actors are recognizing a transition of power, and or do you think that you need to walk back slightly from, if you get enough people not believing in a presidential election being not my president, that you don't have negative ramifications? I'm curious what you think about that, Ken.
Hey, it's before, a great question. Ken, before you answer, I just want to just really quickly mention something. I'm sorry, but it was actually a total of 8 senators who objected to at least one of those certifications, and 139 House members. And I just want to point out, I think this is critically important to point out, that is well over half in the House of the Republicans in the House of Representatives who objected to that. And I just really wanted to highlight that. Sorry, I just.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And actually, although I want to be slightly more fair to the Republicans and on the Senate side, I completely agree with your criticism of the ones on the House side. But on the Senate side, I think some of the 8, which is already a small number that you're counting, were people who voted in favor of the objection against Arizona before the violence started. Right. So I think the number of senators who continued to vote for objections after they reconvened was somewhat lower than that. But I think the general point that you made and that was implied in Trey's question, I have to agree with. I am less optimistic about the strength of our institutions today than I was a few days ago. Now, I will say they did hold up. Biden is the president. And until we got to that vote in the Senate and the House, really no actor exercising real power, you know, except for momentarily that one Wayne County commissioner, had actually abused their real power. There was quite a lot of irresponsible rhetoric out there, but not a lot of abuses of real power. I think until we got to the electoral vote count and what the majority of Republican members of the House did was they tried to end our democracy. Now, maybe they wouldn't have tried if they thought they had a chance of succeeding. But actually, you know, you didn't mention this, but rather alarmingly, the same day in Pennsylvania, the House Republicans in the state legislature did in fact succeed in refusing to seat a Democrat who won their election.
To be clear, we're going to actually talk about that if we have time in this show and definitely in the midweek show, because yes, I think that's a really important potentially trickle down effect if you kind of want to think about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think they happened concurrently. So I think it was part of a unified strategy as much as a trickle down. But, I do think you're right that our institutions, I would say they have continued to hold the way I said, but they're certainly under more stress than they've ever been. And so there's less of a guarantee that they'll keep continuing to hold. So I have to acknowledge your point there.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that, sorry, Ken, that on your point there, I think it's important when you're looking at the votes to not certify those results, that there is something, I think, what you might call of a free rider problem, in the sense that there are a lot of members who realize that certainly this wasn't going to happen. And it made them a lot easier to made it easier for them to vote for that. And I think you're right that if there'd been the very real possibility of perhaps the results not being certified, that would have changed the calculus a little bit.
Yeah, although it could go the other way too. It could
be that
they, if they saw that it was within their power to actually steal the election, maybe they would have done it. So it's very hard to know how people think about that.
But another thing I wanted to point out is, you mentioned that a lot of people mentioned there were a number of senators who changed their votes or what they were planning on voting after the mob took over the Capitol. And I wonder, why would they, if they honestly thought? I mean, it's one thing certainly to cry in the strongest terms mob violence and takeovers of the Capitol, for sure. But if they legitimately believed that these results are not valid, then why would that change their minds at all? I don't understand, and I think for the same reason, earlier that week when Representative Chip Roy brought that objection up to seating members from these disputed states, that there were two members of Congress or two members of the House only who voted for that. And it just shows what a complete and utter ridiculous and just disgusting sham that these objections are.
Well, in short, what you're trying to, I kind of want to expand on what you're saying there, Mike, because you're alluding to it. Effectively, if the election is invalid, then all of the things that you voted on for those ballots have to, by definition, be invalid.
Yeah. And now you could say, for instance, well, if pushed, well, it's just because these weren't big enough gaps, or these gaps were so big that it wouldn't make a difference. But there were a couple of races in some of these so-called disputed states that were close enough where if there was a sort of massive vote fraud that's being alleged, they very well could have made a difference. And so, again, this is I hate the term political stunt because it almost seems to minimize it. This was a calculated anti-democratic action done, for personal ambition. And it's disgusting. And anyone who calls themselves a patriotic American should be totally and thoroughly disgusted by this.
Yeah, Michael, I agree with that. I want to just address, though, I think the distinction that I was drawing last week, and I think Trey is right to push me on this, or a couple months ago, because that's the last time I was on this, is that I always agreed with what you just said, that that none of these people really believe that this was a fraudulent election, that they're lying, that it's a stunt. I always believed that. But what I didn't believe was that I thought you could distinguish between a political stunt, which is just in the rhetoric of some of these politicians, versus responsible elected officials who actually have to exercise power. And I think what we had seen up and down the line until Congress on Wednesday was that Democratic and Republican officials alike, whether they were judges, whether they were secretaries of state, whether they were on boards of elections, they were all exercising their power correctly. So in this environment where politicians were engaging in this irresponsible rhetoric of lies, it wasn't really filtering down to the level of that people in positions of authority were actually abusing their power. And I don't really think we did see that until the House vote on Wednesday. But then, that's where I was kind of conceding to Trey that that's where the distinction I was trying to draw before between mere rhetoric versus an actual attempt to steal an election. I think that distinction didn't hold up on Wednesday. I think that what happened there with those House votes was that it was much closer to an actual attempt to steal an election.
Yeah.
So I want to turn you guys a little bit here. So, you know, they're kind of at the prediction, but I also want to turn and think about the events themselves. And I want to start with this. The day, Wednesday, began with a speech by President Trump where he encouraged his supporters, again after claiming the election was stolen, to march on the Capitol. Now, once the storming of the Capitol was underway, President Trump released a video calling those individuals, quote, very special, and then noting, quote, we love you. In a tweet now removed by Twitter, an issue I'm going to return to in a moment, the president typed the following, quote, these are the things and events that happen when a scared landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from great patriots who have been badly and unfairly treated for so long. Ivanka Trump would go so far as to call the people in the Capitol patriots while they were in the building before shortly later deleting the tweet. Now, originally, I wanted to kind of start with Jay and Ken, but instead, Ken, I'm going to turn to you primarily as you're in law and ask, do you think that the actions of President Trump on Wednesday, his words, his speech, his tweets, do they constitute a crime? Mitt Romney said, quote, this is what the president has caused today, this insurrection, end quote. Specifically, what I'm asking you, Ken, is, do you think the standard of imminent lawless action, as outlined in Brandenburg v. Ohio 1969, as amended again in case law by Hess versus Indiana in 1973, which argues that speech can be prosecuted that leads to, quote, imminent disorder, end quote, has been met? So even if we're never going to see this prosecuted, do you think the president's comments at the outset of Wednesday and then the subsequent storming rise to that constitutional level?
Yeah, although I would actually look at this in a slightly different legal context. So the cases that you cite, one from Ohio and one from Indiana, they're dealing with the question of whether those particular state laws at issue were consistent with the First Amendment. And particularly in Brandenburg, it's in a context where there was no criminal conspiracy. There was only speech. There was no subsequent crime. I think I would look at this in a somewhat different context. I don't think the First Amendment is the key issue in this case, because what would be alleged here is not that his speech was unlawful, but that he was part of a criminal conspiracy to commit the crimes that happened at the Capitol. So it would be the conduct that would be being punished, and he would be being prosecuted as an accomplice or accessory to that conduct, as someone who actually planned and organized it and had a role in it. So it wouldn't be it would be a very different situation if he gave a speech like that and it wasn't connected to any kind of organized scheme to commit crimes that were actually committed. You know, then we'd be talking about the First Amendment, but I wouldn't really look at this primarily in a First Amendment lens. I would look at it through the lens of whether he can be proved to be guilty of being an accomplice or an accessory to the crimes that actually were committed, which were not speech crimes. So and I think he can. Yes, by the way. Yeah, and I would say yes. I'd say there's a number of crimes where it does seem that he actively organized and encouraged and played a role in actually getting, you know, that he not only encouraged people to think about doing this, he played a role in organizing them to actually do this.
Now, this is a question for both of you then in that light, and that is, so there's one is, do we think it rises to that level? And Ken, you're getting at that and making the case that legally speaking, we have to think about this in terms of behavior and conspiracy, not as a speech issue. So my question then becomes, do you think that if you were the prosecutor, let me ask it this way, if you were a prosecutor, would you carry forward with this case? And that's for both of you. In other words, do you think it is the right thing to move forward with some kind of repercussion for Donald Trump post his presidency?
Let me just say that I actually did. I mean, obviously, Ken, you're the law professor, and I'm sure as hell not, but I disagree with you on that. I think you could maybe stretching things quite a lot, make a case the sort of things that Donald Trump said and has done in organizing that rally that became a mob. Those are the sort of things that we've seen politicians do from time immemorial, really. And I just do not think, even if one could perhaps bring a case, that would have even a snowball's chance of being successful. And so maybe there's some value in bringing that case. But to me, this is exactly what impeachment and removal are for. And it's more of a, this is a not necessarily a criminal code violation that you can get some sort of a prosecution, you know, successful prosecution of, but that's something that certainly rises to the level that would should lead to impeachment and removal. And it does seem to, it sure looks at this point like there will at least be another impeachment, though there's no way there's going to be a removal by the Senate.
So Trey, I would keep investigating. I'm not saying that he could be prosecuted just simply based on the speech that he gave on Wednesday morning. But if you can show, and I think there's questions about these things that need to be investigated, that he actually influenced the Defense Department not to fortify the building, that he delayed the National Guard from being sent over, that he played additional roles to make sure that the Capitol would likely be breached, besides just telling the crowd to go over there, then I do think he does meet the statutory definitions. And I put a couple of them up here. So in Title 18, which is the U.S. Criminal Code, there's a couple sections in a row that I think could apply. Section 2383, 2384, 2385. They deal with rebellion, insurrection, seditious conspiracy, or advocating overthrow of government. And the statutory language says, whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engages in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for 10 years. And then if two or more persons conspire to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against it, or to oppose by force its authority, or by force to prevent or hinder or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States, contrary to the authority thereof, then that's a 20-year prison sentence. So I think, you know, I wouldn't prosecute him if the only evidence that he did any of that was just the public speech that he gave. But I don't know that that's all there is to it. So I would like to see it investigated. And I actually think, given that this case could be prosecuted in D.C., that it wouldn't be impossible to find a jury that would convict him.
That's interesting. So you very different positions on that one. Now, I want to kind of back a little bit away from the legal aspect of it and talk about the speech and the political communication aspect of it for just a minute. And I want to follow up by asking, well, what we see happening in the wake of Wednesday is a variety of different responses from social media companies. Facebook has banned Trump for the remainder of his term in office, ironically sending its stock higher on the markets yesterday. Twitter took down his tweets and locked his account until he would remove some additional offending material, and it wouldn't reappear until Thursday, when he had a much calmer video to post. And so my question to the two of you is what do you think the role of social media companies is in these kinds of moments? As a matter of fact, it was only a few years ago that there was a lot of scholarly interest in the idea that lowercase democratic movements might find expression and life in online spaces and via social media. As a matter of fact, the Arab Springs were thought to be advanced by Twitter and other social media platforms, so much so that the State Department itself asked Twitter to delay maintenance on its servers to allow for individuals to be using Twitter. Now there seems to be a desire for there to be an editor or a censor on social media. So what do you guys think about this idea? Should we be banning false, inflammatory, or other kinds of comments on social media like Twitter and Facebook? Or do you think this is fundamentally a mistake as a result of just the high tensions of what was happening on Wednesday and Thursday?
Well, you know, I think Facebook certainly, we knew that this was coming. Well, we didn't know. The three of us didn't know that this was coming, not to this extent. But anyone who was and should have been in the law enforcement community there monitoring these groups on Facebook and Twitter and Parler and Gab and all these places. There was tons of evidence that this was coming and it was going to be bad. And so, the fact of the matter is, you know, Facebook, once they heard about this, once they saw these groups form, they would take them down pretty quickly. But that's the problem with these open communication methods. I mean, it makes it super easy for, you know, for dissidents and for bad people of all sorts to get together very quickly. That's the strength of these platforms, but that's the big weakness of these platforms. And that's why, that's the main reason, I think, why I'm just so incredibly pessimistic about the future, is because I don't see that infrastructure changing in any fundamental way. That's just not going to happen. And social media just makes it very easy for bad people to get together and plan stuff. And we saw the result of it on Wednesday.
Ken, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I would distinguish between the social media giants like Facebook and Twitter and the internet itself. I think there may be some role for the government to say that the internet, in some sense, the internet backbone providers should be some kind of common carrier and should have to keep all content up there, at least if it's legal content, the way the phone network has been regulated in the past. I'm very open to that kind of idea, public utilities type regulation. However, I wouldn't ever apply that to particular websites like Facebook and Twitter. They should certainly have editorial control over what they want to post, because you know they're gonna dramatically increase the size of the platform for anybody that uses their service. And so it's their service. They certainly should have a role in deciding who they want to amplify and who they want to block, who they want to be associated with and who they don't. I can't really even really understand the arguments that they shouldn't. And I think Trump, you know, in his campaign to get Section 230 of the Communications Act repealed, I think he completely had a reverse understanding of what Section 230 actually does. Section 230 makes it possible for Facebook and Twitter not to delete all his posts. It gives them the right to leave his posts up if they want to. They would have to delete all his posts if it wasn't for Section 230, because they would be as liable as him. Yep. For any harmful conduct content that he posts there. So he was really trying to get repealed the section of the Communications Act that immunizes the platform owner if they let a third party content provider like him put up harmful content. And I could see repealing that. I could actually agree with him on that, but I don't think it would do what he thinks it would do.
Let me ask you some political communication. I think one of the things I'm trying to get at here, and you guys had phenomenal answers, but I want to narrow us a little bit, is I think for a long time there's been the idea that free open communication is going to lead to the best possible outcomes. And I think we haven't.
Yeah. Sorry. But, how naive that is. My God, you know. But anyway.
Well,
sorry.
I mean, even if it is. But here's the other side of that, of course, is I don't think any of us want closed platforms. I think what may have happened is there was probably a lot of kind of utopian thinking about some of these platforms. You know, Twitter was going to be only ever used for good purposes, and therefore that's what it is. But it's not what human beings are about. We do all kinds of weird and crazy and sometimes bad things. So I guess what I'm kind of wondering here is that what are your guys' feelings on this shift to a non-editorialized world? Because it appears that Facebook and Twitter are trying to maybe bring in, as you're suggesting, Ken, some of that that censor editorializing back. And I think that's kind of what here is the question. Is that the kind of behavior that we need? So what do you think about that for political communication in general? Does it help? I mean, you know, Mike, you were laughing. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess having grown up in a pre-social media and almost kind of a pre-internet age in a way, you know, I start to see all of a sudden the many virtues of very high barriers to entry in publishing your own crazy rants and organizing and so forth. And so I'm not as I guess I'm not as bought into that sort of utopian thinking. I never really was. I mean, and you can go back as far as radio and television. I'm talking about how it's going to lead to a wonderful era of people just following hours long Lincoln Douglas type debates and becoming incredibly well informed and all that. And, you know, and everything gets used for porn and then everything else, I guess, you know, and that's kind of how it is. People being what they are. So, yeah,
Ken, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I do. There's actually a little bit of discussion of this in the legal academic scholarship. I'll start with some older thinking on this, which relates to what Mike just said. Lee Bollinger, who's now the president of Columbia University, he had a long and distinguished academic career as a law professor at Michigan. And one of the First Amendment ideas that he pioneered back when the FCC was heavily regulating content on broadcast media, the era that Mike was talking about when he grew up, and when I grew up, the FCC used to enforce a fairness doctrine. You know, they would require local broadcasters to cover controversial issues of public concern, to air perspectives on both sides. If the station had a perspective, they could air their own perspective, and then they had to invite in a member of the public with an opposing perspective. The FCC used to regulate news distortion, so stations could lose their license if it was found that they were propagandizing or airing fake news. There was a lot of that regulation, and Bollinger used to talk about, you know, how could that be consistent with the First Amendment? And his idea was it was consistent with the First Amendment because broadcast was just one media. And he argued it would be completely inconsistent with the First Amendment to extend that that type of regulation to all forms of media. But he said it was good to have both a more or less unregulated world of print media where anybody could, you know, print up a few copies of their own magazine or pamphlet and distribute it to, you know, no matter what it said, and had to have a complete First Amendment right to do that. And fringe ideas could get out there and there were no official truths. But at the same time, we had this kind of more verified media where, you know, we had the broadcast media, and if people turned on ABC or NBC or CBS News, and it was subject to all that kind of FCC regulation and protection for reasonable perspectives from both sides, like what we try to do here on The Politics Guys. Bollinger's argument was that was the best of all worlds, to have a First Amendment that applied very strongly in the print world and to have forms of regulation of quality and honesty and checks and balances that applied very strongly in the broadcast world, and to make both of those things available. Now, in more modern First Amendment thinking, again, a professor at Columbia named Tim Wu has probably written the most about this. He's got a famous article from just a couple years ago called Is the First Amendment Obsolete? And Wu's argument, which I think is what you were getting at, Trey, is he says, well, in the old days, people presumed that the greatest threat to free speech was direct punishment by the government of speakers. But Wu says, but now because of the internet, the greatest threat to free speech is people who seek to use new methods that rely on the weaponization of speech itself, such as the deployment of troll armies, the fabrication of news, flooding tactics, online trolling that seeks to humiliate, harass, discourage, or destroy targeted speakers. And Wu argues that because the threats to free speech have changed so much from when free speech was theorized, he uses a metaphor of cheap speech, and he says, you know, now that there's so much cheap speech out there, that you really can't satisfy the needs of our democracy without again having some gatekeepers. So I think that's sort of some modern thinking in First Amendment legal scholarship that relates, I think, to the question that you were asking.
No, definitely. Yeah.
You know, guys, on the communication issue, I just wanted to say, I don't know if this occurred to any of you, but if someone had told me that a mob would storm the Capitol and disrupt its business in the, you know, peaceful transition of power type of process, and the president of the United States was not that evening or the next day giving a nationally televised address, I would think that how bizarre is that, right? I mean, even you would think that Donald Trump would want to even Donald Trump would want to do that. And the fact that I guess the fact that he sort of, you know, was the person who incited that is a problem there. But this is where we're at, you know, and how it's so hard for me to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, I think that those kinds of technological changes might, I think they have implications politically. As a matter of fact, I've spent a good portion of my career examining that. And I can't say that I was as surprised and you know, maybe not a Joe Biden and a Donald Trump, but I think that in the future, you will not see kind of the national televised speeches in the way that you once did, in large part because that's just not where people are watching things, not because they're not trying to reach the same target audience with their platform. But I disagree
with that. I think you're wrong on that, Trey, because I think still that nationally televised speech is still reaches far more people than somebody's Twitter account or anything like that. I still think that there's a role for that. There's going to be for quite a long period of time. Well, not quite a long period, but certainly for at least the next, say, half decade to decade or so.
Well, if you take a look at modern statistics of those who are in the 29 and under, and then specifically in the 21 and under category, you're talking about network penetration in the teens and lower for in the last 6 months of viewership. So, I mean, when you take a look at the whole population, of course, we're skewed older. So, you know, that could be still the case temporarily. I think as those numbers is the same way that we saw smartphone penetration move from nothing now to where I think approximately 91% of the population, and did it more rapidly than television did, right? Television deployed much more slowly over a longer period of time. I'd slightly disagree with you, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying. And yeah, I think though what the nationally televised thing does is it provides the fodder. It's the thing that all of those Twitter feeds and everything else will kind of, you know, on YouTube will sort of play off of. And so even though, you know, 18 to 29 folks aren't certainly, you know, tuning into ABC on their, you know, on their cathode ray TV or something like that, they're still probably getting it from a Twitter feed or from Facebook or YouTube or something like that. And so it's still having that effect. It's just kind of going through a sort of intermediary, if you will.
I'm going to flip it just a little bit still on you before I move on to the next question, because, for example, I was watching PBS NewsHour while I was walking on a treadmill the other day on Wednesday, trying to burn off some fat and some nasty energy from the day. And what was fascinating about it is that while they were having the conversation, both reporters on the scene were actually reading real-time Twitter updates from their phones from the same people that I was looking at on my phone next to the television that was attached to the treadmill. So in other words, instead of what was happening on the television informing what was happening on Twitter, Twitter was determining what was happening on the television.
A
potential flip. Anyway. So let's move forward. I think we've gotten a little bit down that rabbit hole. The next trend that I really want to talk about is something that I did see playing out in real time on Wednesday. And this is one of the reasons, in fact, I was going for my walk. The number of individuals supporting the actions of the violence on Wednesday. And there was a common theme among many of them, even among a few lawmakers. I may or may not have had choice words to one of them as I was walking on the treadmill. And that was effectively that what we saw played out on Wednesday was no different than what happened this summer with the Black Lives Matter protests. And therefore, the unrest that we saw across many cities in America was simply the extension of Democratic ill play. And now it was just simply our turn, Republicans' turn, conservatives' turn, to have a go at a city. In other words, if Democrats can do it, why can't Republicans? And I bring this up not because I support this view, but rather I see this as being a relatively mainstream view. And I'm actually going to have some statistics to ask some follow-up questions for both of you. But just to start here, what do you say to that comparison, and what do you say to the individuals who are in real time supporting what they saw happening on the Capitol?
Well, I'll start with this. I heard a lot of the anti-Black Lives Matter rhetoric over the course of the last year, really extolling this idea that blue lives matter. Now, yesterday, what we saw was something we never saw at any Black Lives Matter protest. We saw these rioters beat to death a uniformed Capitol Police officer with a fire extinguisher. There was never any violence against any police at any Black Lives Matter protests ever. And it really makes you wonder how much these people believe that blue lives matter when some of them were actually saying that even during the riots, when they confronted the Capitol Police, they're saying, let us in. We're on your side. We're the Blue Lives Matter guys. But when push came to shove, that didn't stop them from beating one of them to death and injuring dozens of them, I think that never happened in any Black Lives Matter protests. And I think even at the one other time that I remember in 2020 when an officer was shot, it was at a Black Lives Matter protest in Nevada. But it turned out the shooter was a Boogaloo person who had come there to a right winger who had tried to shoot a police officer to make it look like the Black Lives Matter protester did that and was arrested for it. So that's not just a rumor that happened. So I think that's a pretty huge difference. Black Lives Matter protesters never came armed. All these people came armed. To me, the only real thing I'd seen before that this was reminiscent of was the armed protests at the Michigan State House. And you remember, I was quite upset about that at the time.
That was actually when we discussed it. And Mike, what do you
and let's keep in mind that President Trump's own Department of Homeland Security said that the greatest domestic threat to this country right now is white nationalist terrorism. And we saw that in action. And, certainly there was a huge distinction to be made between something like in Portland where, there were some reprehensible things that went on. There was violence and vandalism of a federal courthouse. But as far as I recall, they did not actually take over that courthouse and stop the business of that court. And also, it's one thing to even if they had done that, it's still a whole other level to go to the United States Capitol and disrupt, try to disrupt the peaceful transition of power. So that's a whole other level, certainly. And I think in part, though, we certainly see some very important differences in how in what the law enforcement response was. And I guess I'm sympathetic in part to the argument that, there was a huge overreaction to the BLM rallies in the summer. And so, supposedly DC and all the other authorities didn't want to go there. But still, given all of the intelligence that they absolutely must have had, I think that was just criminal. Maybe not literally. I don't know, Ken, maybe it was criminal, but certainly I think it was, it was awful.
Well, I'll just kind of briefly just say that I would flip the script on that and simply argue that I think that what many in the Black Lives Matter movement experienced and what I saw on that side is simply that the weak response by Capitol Police is probably a great example of structural racism. I find it hard to believe that the response would have been identical had you had armed African Americans storming the Capitol in mass, but we can leave that kind of there for a minute because I know we have a lot of things to talk about. I was told I was going to push you guys back with another bit of data, and that's what I want to turn my next attention to. It's related to that last question. On Wednesday, there was a real-time YouGov poll, and in that poll, 1,397 registered voters, 62% of them perceived Wednesday as a threat to democracy. And you might think, wow, I wish that number was higher, but at least it's maybe a majority. But when you start breaking those numbers down, we start to see that there's some vast differences by party. Among Republicans, 45%, again, on Wednesday, 45% of Republicans actively supported the actions on the Capitol, slightly more than those who opposed. Among the far-right theories, we now range from it was a setup and AFTO is working with Capitol Police to even more wild conspiracy theories. Among Republicans, Trump remains popular, but national polling by Politico on Friday indicates that he has dipped to all-time lows of 60% of disapproval rating. So here's my question. In a world in which 45% of Republicans don't just think that Trump won, but actually support the actions of Wednesday. When those two parties are this far apart, what does the path forward over the next 4 years look like? Do you think those numbers stay the same? Do you think this is a shift? It's a blip? What do you think about that?
Those numbers are already starting to shift a little bit. I think in more recent polling, we're starting to see the opposition numbers to what happened go up a little bit. Because I think that first poll was kind of right in the moment and people really hadn't had a chance to sort of understand what was going on. But even so, I still think there's going to be a reasonable percentage of Republicans, maybe 20%, I don't know, that will approve of them, because there are tens of millions of people, it seems like, out there who believe that this election was stolen. You know, I think it's important to try to look at it from their perspective. And this is not to excuse any of this activity, certainly not. But if I were in that position and I believed that the democratic process was being completely perverted by a vast conspiracy of people, and I knew that because everyone that I trusted and believed in up into and including the president of the United States was telling me that, I would be damn angry too. And I don't think I would ever riot, but I certainly might understand where they were coming from. And so again, this is not to certainly hold these people blameless, but when we want to point fingers and assign blame, it's to those evil people who are manipulating those folks with the false information they know to be false. And that starts right with President Donald Trump.
Ken, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. I mean, that's what I really, it took me really all the way until this week to fully understand. So maybe Michael understood that before me. But yeah, I think it's hard to blame them for thinking what they think if so many authority figures that they trust are telling them that that's the truth. So you really I think the blame really does go back to, of course, to the president, but also to these 108 members of the House, to some of the network. I don't think Fox News has been as bad as usual on this, but the other new right wing cable networks, and there's
Newsmax,
just a lot of sources.
Thinking about, for example.
Yeah. Newsmax, yep. And ONN. Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's understandable if you really thought the election had been stolen and somehow the perpetrators are actually getting away with it, and that's what the threat to our democracy is, then I could see being very angry. Now, I will say I thought that in 2000, and yet I didn't go commit violence inside the U.S. Capitol. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's ways to deal with this and there's ways to deal with this. But I certainly do understand why some people would be taking the actions that they're taking, given what they've been told by authority figures.
Now, gentlemen, the situation around Trump has always been volatile, to say the least, but no more so in the last 48 hours. Mike Pence, for example, according to Oklahoma's Inhofe, and VP Chief of Staff Mark Short tells us that privately, Mike Pence is raging at Trump for throwing him under the bus. Now, I can't say that I have much sympathy for Pence. Like, we'll save that for a minute. But specifically, what he's upset about is he saw his family's safety in jeopardy, and Trump didn't seem to care. Yet, it's kind of hard for many of us to feel sympathy for Trump, as I was kind of noting, because he's been nothing but a staunch Trump loyalist. But over the past 48 hours, a number of theoretically staunch Trump loyalists have been exiting his circle, including Betsy DeVos, Elaine Chao, Mick Mulvaney, Pottinger, and more from the First Lady's office. So for many, this seems like a lot too little, a lot too late. Vice President Pence, for example, has had a front row seat at the unfolding and only now apparently cares. So are these resignations meaningful? Do you think that there might be some individuals who are finally recognizing what goes forward? And what do you think happens with Vice President Pence specifically next, gentlemen?
Well, you know, I'm torn on this because I guess I can understand that there are some people who have tried to tell themselves that, well, he is a bad guy, he is an unstable guy, but I will be in here and I will try to do the best I can to try to minimize the damage. And they kept on telling themselves, and it's easy to get in that mind frame and let it go a little bit further and a little bit further. And then something like this just finally just shakes you into reality and say, oh my God. And I'd like to think that that's the reason for at least some of these resignations. I'm trying to look at this from a charitable, looking at these folks in the best possible light. But, you know, the cynical side of me says, well, you're trying to just a little bit of political theater and you're going to lose your job in 2 weeks anyway. But I hope that at least in some cases, that's not the case. And I also want to say that I'm on the resignations. I'm really glad that a lot of the national security establishment folks aren't resigning, it seems like, because we need those people in place during this next 2 weeks, because God only knows what would happen if all of a sudden there's more turnover in there. And, you know, I certainly hope not anything serious, but who knows at this point?
Yeah, so I would distinguish Pence from the cabinet secretaries you mentioned. I mean, the cabinet secretaries, I don't give any credit whatsoever to Betsy DeVos or Elaine Chao for saying that they're resigning out of principle now. I mean, they're saving themselves having to be pressured one way or the other on a possible 25th Amendment vote. They're trying to rehabilitate their own reputations a little bit. And as Mike said, they'd be out of a job in 2 weeks anyhow. So I look at that as just tokenism. I don't think it means anything. Now Pence, I could almost feel a little sorry for him, because I think he's got nowhere to go and there's no right answers for him. You know, I think the Trumpers have turned against him at this point. I don't think he gets them back. And I think by he's trying to still be loyal, not invoke the 25th Amendment, this and that, but it's not going to work. I think he's tainted in the eyes of the Trumpers, but I think he's also tainted in the eyes of most other people because of his close association with Trump over these years. So he may have a little bit of a political career in Indiana if he wants it, but I think he's done with national politics now, and it's just kind of dawning on him. And I don't think it matters much at this point whether he resigns or whether he rides out his last 2 weeks. He probably ought to ride out his last 2 weeks just for the same reasons, as Mike said, the Secretary of Defense, the acting Secretary of Defense and the acting Undersecretaries of Defense are all doing.
Well, you guys both noted impeachment earlier. You did, Mike, and Ken, you right here, you were talking about the 25th Amendment. And that kind of leads into this next question, which is, on Thursday, Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer both called on Trump being removed from office, both through the 25th Amendment and through the use of impeachment. Now, what's interesting about this is that the National Review on the 6th even had an issue entitled, quote, Trump Must Pay, which argued, verbatim, a sitting president of the United States, having lost re-election, incited a mob to storm the Capitol as Congress sat in joint session. The lawbreakers cannot go unpunished, nor can the person ultimately responsible. His name is Donald Trump. That's the end of the quote. So the article that I'm here from the National Review makes it clear that it wasn't an idea. It was the personification of power, which was the fighting they were leading solely for Donald Trump, not for conservatism, not for a political idea. And it's not often that you're going to see National Review, Democratic leadership, left and right agree. Do you guys agree? Is invoking the 25th Amendment the right thing to do? Is another impeachment process the right thing to do? Yes or no?
No and yes.
No.
I just wanted to say I am very adamantly against the 25th Amendment thing. I think that is a complete misuse of the 25th Amendment. I mean, Donald Trump is a narcissist. Donald Trump is, I believe, a thoroughly bad and awful and incompetent person, but he is not incompetent in the 25th Amendment sense of things. And so I think that the appropriate remedy is impeachment and removal. And I it's too bad that's not as expeditious as the 25th Amendment. Well, the 25th Amendment gets a little complex, actually. It's not just Mike Pence and the majority of the cabinet. There are steps and procedures. But I think that's a misuse of the 25th Amendment, and it sets a horrible precedent. And so I do not think the 25th Amendment should be in play. I think it's a huge error.
Ken?
Yeah, I can't disagree with Mike on the either the ethics or the original meaning of what would be the right way to go here. But I might disagree with him a little on the practicalities. I think impeachment is actually not only impractical given the timeline, but really would have costs that make it not worth paying, even if it's the right thing to do, because McConnell is still the majority leader right up until the day that Kamala Harris is inaugurated, and maybe even a day or two beyond if the Georgia elections are not certified yet. And there's not really going to be an impeachment trial. But meanwhile, what really needs to happen during this timeline is Biden needs to get some of his cabinet secretaries confirmed. There's almost no cabinet secretaries left who are actual Senate confirmed cabinet secretaries. There's these anonymous Trump lackeys running all these important departments of the government. And I think it's somewhat possible if there's no impeachment that McConnell might agree to start doing some confirmation hearings on January 18th, January 19th. You know, there won't even be any on January 20th or 21st if there's impeachment. And the cost in terms of Biden getting his government up and running for what's really ultimately just political theater about what's right and wrong, because, you know, Trump isn't going to be removed, certainly isn't going to be removed before January 20th, and there might not even be the 2/3 votes there to disqualify him from holding future office, even if the proceeding stretches out past January 20th. So I think it's kind of, there's an educational reason to do the impeachment, but there's not a practical reason to do it. And there's, I think, a strong practical reason not to do it. So I wouldn't do it, even though I think it's merited. But the 25th Amendment, you know, I think I might be a little more open than Mike to the idea that Trump is genuinely off his mind and genuinely mentally ill. And so that this is actually the kind of situation that 25th Amendment really is called for. But I also think it's impractical. It's not going to happen. I don't really mind people putting pressure on Pence to invoke it, but I don't expect it to happen. And I don't think the timeline is much more practical either.
Yeah. You know, I just want to say, I don't think that Donald Trump is going to, I think National Review is right. And a lot of people on the right and the left are right that he should pay, but he's not going to pay. There's not going to be any kind of significant consequences to him. It's just not going to happen. And I want to turn things around, Trey, and I want to ask you a question, because it seems to me that one really important question here is, what is the Republican Party going to look like in the wake of this? Is it going to be the Republican Party of Mitt Romney, the Republican Party of Ben Sasse, or even the Republican Party of Thomas Massey? Or is it going to be the Republican Party of Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley? And I want to get your perspective on that, because I think I know what the answer is, and it depresses the hell out of me. But what do you think as someone who still identifies there?
Well, when we originally were hoping to have Jay and Kristen on the show, I actually had a couple of questions, pointed questions for all three of us. And you've actually kind of summed it up quite nicely, Mike. And I think the answer is simply that I still hold out some hope for the Republican Party. And if there can be anything good that might come of the atrocious events on Wednesday, it might be that those of us in the Republican Party who are actually conservatives, who are actually libertarians, who actually have political principles beyond conspiracy theory and sycophantic connections to Donald Trump, that we might have the opportunity to start kicking the rest of them out of the party. And I think that's really the only path forward. I know that makes me different than others, but I think the Republicans, we need to have a pretty hard and fast test. If you supported the actions of Donald Trump, you're out. And we're not going to support you. We're not going to move forward with you. And my hope is that we can see that happening in the upcoming year, and specifically as we get into the midterm elections in 2022. But I can say this much, and that is that if the Trumpites continue to run the party, I will not be a member of it in the future.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess I hope you're right, certainly. But it seems to me, I just don't see the mechanism for the kicking out of these folks, because I, you know, recalling back into 2016 saying, you know, certainly we can't have Donald Trump be our nominee. And yet it's, you know, it's the very opening up of this primary process to the most energetic, the most politically engaged people, both on the right and on the left, that get you these kind of results. And, you know, I, for one, certainly think there's something to be said for smoke-filled rooms and beauty contests, primaries and all that kind of pre-1968 sort of stuff.
Well, I don't want to argue with someone who's not present. because again, you know, Jay's not here, but my hope is that the Jays of the world will come over to my position and effectively say, you know what, I was wrong. That's what I'm putting my hope on, Mike, is that I think there were too many Republicans who were willing to deal with the devil because they were going to get a few things like Supreme Court nominees, that they were going to blink at what they saw as these minor discretion. I disagree that they're minor, but my hope is that by having something this large, this just undefensible, that the what I think are reasonable conservatives like Jay, although we don't agree on everything, we found ourselves in the same party, would be willing to agree with me and say, you know what, I erred on this one, and let's move forward. That's where I'm banking that there's going to be hope. If the Jays of the world are not willing to make that position, then I don't have much, as you've noted.
Because, you know, I'm thinking that, again, you know, something like 60% of House Republicans voted, you know, in the way that they did. And they did that with, a clear political calculus here, because so many of those districts are so gerrymandered and they're concerned about maybe getting primaries for the right. So I don't know if there's much hope for the House unless we fix gerrymandering, and that's not going to happen. and in terms of the presidency, again, I see a lot of people just saying, well, you know, yeah, but this guy isn't Donald Trump, at least, but maybe he's a smarter version of Donald Trump, because for so long, you know, a lot of us both on the left and the right have been saying, well, thank God Donald Trump is at least incompetent, because how horrible could he be if he were a decent, you know, dictator wannabe? And I think there's a lot to that. And I think the person who comes after Donald Trump, I don't think it's going to be Josh Hawley. I think he's just kind of like a test version of that. But whoever it is, I can totally see someone coming up who's a little bit smarter and a little bit less blunt, but can still kind of do some of those dog whistles and play to those folks. And it's going to be a lot more disastrous. Again, maybe it's Wednesday, but I think, you know, you all know that I've been pretty pessimistic about the future of American democracy for a while now, actually.
You know, Mike, one word that you said I want to pick up on, and that's the word gerrymandering. I think that is a cause of a lot of the craziness that we're seeing, because it does tend to mean that if Republicans who are running for state legislatures or for Congress only ever have to worry about being primaried from the right and never have to worry about a general election, it just pushes things farther and farther out into what I would think of as crazy land. But I actually, the one glimmer of hope I see here for the future, I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but I know here in Ohio, when Kasich was still our governor, he actually was worried about that. He didn't love, you know, being pressured by the far right crazies all the time, you know, as a Republican governor. And he did make common cause with Democrats and with some centrist Republican legislators. And they did adopt districting reform. Now, it hasn't taken effect yet. It's going to take effect after the results of the 2020 census are out. But we are going to have some districting reform here. That may lead to a little bit more political moderation, because if the districts are more competitive, then candidates are going to have to move back towards the center a little bit. And I think there's a path there for other Republican governors to be influenced by that. I think that's who the key players are going to be. But if Republican governors support districting reform to push back against gerrymandering, I think that is something that could have a beneficial effect on our politics and stop some of these problems you're talking about from getting a lot worse.
Yeah, I hope you're right. But more and more, I think we see things like where state legislatures are getting radicalized. There's the Pennsylvania case, and we're probably not going to have the time to talk about that. Maybe you and Trey will talk about that on the bonus show. But where you have these strong majorities in some cases, well, like in Kentucky, these super majorities that just decide we're going to make the governor a non-entity to the extent that we can. And we've seen that in a bunch of states that Republicans have taken over with large enough majorities to basically take the governor out of the picture to a scary extent, really, in a lot of cases.
I mean, if the gerrymandering gets as effective as that, then there's nothing that can be done about it in the near term. But there's also states where if a Republican governor made a deal with the Democratic minority in the legislature, they would be able to pick up enough centrist Republicans to put legislation through. And that is what happened in Ohio. I don't think it's impossible in some states, but certainly under present conditions in Kentucky, that would be impossible, but not everywhere.
Well, I know we're starting to run out of time, and so I want to get to one very last thing for both of you, and that's something that came out on Friday. And what that is that Trump made public his decision that he would not be attending the inauguration of President-elect Biden. And that would mean that he would be the fourth president to purposefully not attend an inauguration, joining John Adams, John Quincy Adams, and Andrew Johnson. Woodrow Wilson wouldn't attend Harding's in 1921, but that was due to poor health. He would actually ride to the Capitol with Harding. Nixon wouldn't attend Ford's, but of course he had already resigned and left Washington in disgrace. So this might seem like a small issue, but earlier in the week, and this is something we're going to talk about more in the midweek show as well, myself and Ken, you know, Trump pressured Georgia's Secretary of State to find him 11,000 more votes and threatened him with legal action if he didn't do so. And I think a lot of this has been lost amid Wednesday's events. And so here's my capper to the show question for each of you. Do you think that the norms broken, small, like not attending the inauguration, to large, demanding Secretary of State's find him votes, is going to leave a lasting impact on the presidency? I know in the past, all of you have answered negatively. So I'm going to ask you again, do you think that in the future, presidential scholars are going to piece up the presidency the way they have for some time between the pre and the modern presidency, and the tipping point being FDR? Do you think in the future that Donald Trump will mark a difference in the presidency pre and post his presidency?
Wow, that's a good question, Trey. You know, I think to me, a lot depends on who the next Republican nominee is. I think if it is somebody like, and I kind of pit the Ben Sasse against the Josh Hawley because they're both, you know, hugely ambitious guys in there. I think they're both still in their 40s. I know Hawley is, and Sasse, and they're looking at themselves as potential presidential candidates. And I think if the Republicans nominate someone like Sasse, whether he, you know, wins, or assuming he doesn't lose too badly, I hope to, with the eventual winner, I think that makes a big difference, actually. You know, but my fear, and what I think is going to happen, is going to be someone much more in the mold of a Hawley who's going to get the nomination, in which case, yeah, I totally can see it being sort of a pre and post Trump, especially given the fact that I don't really see any major changes happening in social media. There'll be something maybe, but not a whole lot. And certainly not given the Congress we have, because, you know, there's not going to be enough opportunity for a Biden administration to do anything like that. And as technology improves with the ability to do deep fakes and make lies more and more plausible, I think it's entirely possible that idea of yours that we're going to see kind of the post-Trump type of presidency to be a reality, unfortunately.
Ken, any last thought?
Yeah. It's possible, but I don't think it's a sure thing or even a likely thing. Trump, you know, is a one-termer. One-termers tend to have less influence on the shape of the presidency than two-termers. Trump is pretty disgraced right now. It's true that Biden's also, you know, going to be a one-termer. Doesn't necessarily mean that he won't be succeeded by another Democrat, but I'm sure he's not ever going to run for re-election. So there's a lot of contingent future here. But I don't think that Trump did anything that's going to endear himself either to historians or to people who are looking for ways to, win and hold together, hold things together for another term. So I think he's done some harm, and he's certainly, everything that he did and got away with, every crime he committed and got away with, it creates a precedent for someone else to think, well, I can get away with that too. But I don't know that ultimately it looks like he really got away with it all. I know Michael said he is never going to be held accountable, but he, of course, has been held accountable by the voters. The system held up against his assault. He is going out in disgrace, and he may yet be held accountable for various kinds of crimes, both in federal law and state law. He's certainly going to be sued quite a lot, I think, now that he's out, and have a lot of civil liability. And so I don't know that he's gotten away with it all. And I don't know that I don't see a lot of reason for people to emulate many of the things that he did. I hope not, anyhow.
Yeah. I will point out, because since I won't get a chance to talk about this, I'm sure your guys will on the, you guys might on the bonus show. But one way in which the voters held him accountable as well, or at least the party would see it this way, is that, you know, his influence almost certainly cost them the two Georgia seats and control of the Senate. And that's certainly something that a lot of the money people are going to be considering and going forward. So my hope is that enough people with enough clout are going to see that, and that, because, you know, I want to be wrong about all of this, of course. I hope Ken's right about this, and Trey, I hope you're right about your optimistic things, and maybe if I get a little break and a little distance from this, I'll be a little more optimistic like you guys too. I don't know.
Well, yeah, actually, on money, if I was going to be done, but I want to pick up that point just for a second. I think one lasting impact of Trump might be, you know, just like we've already seen this realignment in the suburbs, where educated professionals in suburbs who typically had voted Republican, you know, he alienated and pushed them away. Well, a lot of those people are the same people that run America's largest corporations. And I think the corporate lobby, you know, has been pretty Republican for many years. And we may be seeing a realignment of that. And if we're seeing a realignment of that, then that really changes quite a lot, I think, because, you know, money in politics has been a lot easier for Republicans to raise than for Democrats. Now, Democrats have gotten more effective at it with mass online fundraising. But if the Democrats could keep their mass online fundraising going along with becoming the recipients of large corporate money, you know, then that poses a real problem for Republicans, I think, and they might have to moderate themselves to get back in that game.
Well, this has been, you know, one of our longer shows in a while, but I'm not surprised. I think this was important. And I want to kind of close by just saying thank you guys both. And I hope that you've enjoyed doing, I think, kind of a civic duty. But to kind of move to something a little more personal as we close, Mike, don't we have some new donors that we need to thank?
Yeah, actually, there are some. Thanks for reminding me about that. I'd almost forgotten. But yes, I want to thank Hero Eryx, Diana, and Carl, who are our newest supporters on the show. And we really appreciate it. Both on Patreon, you can become a monthly sustaining supporter. Also, a couple of our Diana and Carl supported the show through PayPal, which is another option we have as well. So, you know, you get that. If you are a supporter, you get ad-free versions of our shows, as well as other things at different levels of support. And just to check that out for Patreon, it's patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you want to do the PayPal option, you just go to politicsguys.com/support and you'll find the links there. And really, thanks to all of you, because that really makes this possible. And we really all very much appreciate it.
Agreed. And I want to add, you know, this week for those who become supporters, so maybe you want to join our new supporters, Ken and I are going to be recording here in just a little bit our midweek show, where we're going to tackle a bunch of the things that we didn't have time for in this show. We were talking about the pressure of the Georgia Secretary of State. We have the Pennsylvania legislature refusing to seat a member. There's a lot of really cool things that we're going to be doing on this Wednesday's show. So if you aren't a supporter, now might be a great time to do what Mike said, head to patreon.com/politicsguys or to head to politicsguys.com/support so that you can join us for that Wednesday show. If you've got questions, comments, corrections, or just a random thought you'd like to share, which as a matter of fact, we're going to take on a question on the midweek show, Ken, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Morano, Andra Masker, Nathan Selznowski, Daniel Toe, and Chris Wilkerson. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. I hope you'll join us then.